Welcome back to Sports Identity and the Disability Blues. So excited to be back with you in this new year. And what we're going to do today is special. I'm going to go back and replay the first interview I did for this podcast because I think it'd be cool for some new listeners to check out Sean Dunaway's story. He's a friend of mine. We grew up together in Nuomini, Ohio. He was on the wrestling team. I got into adaptive sports as he's older. He's got kids. Really cool dude. I think you'll enjoy his story. And now to that conversation. What if I told you the most overlooked talent pool in America is also one of the most resilient, skilled, and driven? Winning Abilities is founded on this reality and is here to change the paradigm when it comes to people with disabilities. They're on a mission to unlock potential across all abilities by placing high-performing individuals who have disabilities into top roles in various industries, including technology, finance, marketing, and beyond. But it does not stop there. Through their groundbreaking NIL program, Winning Abilities is empowering adaptive athletes to secure support that further shapes futures on and off the field or court. Because this is more than about jobs or sports. It's about building an ecosystem that creates a lifetime of opportunities for individuals and companies. With its partners, Winning Abilities is bringing new tools to help shape leadership and employment across organizations and helping companies and individuals grow in win-win solutions. So, if you're a hiring leader ready to build a more inclusive team, or someone with talent looking for your next big opportunity, head to winningabilities.com. Ability wins here. I'm so excited to have Sean Dunaway on to talk about his experience. Welcome, Sean.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
No problem. And so let's talk a little bit. First of all, just tell us your story. Tell us a little bit about, like, you know, your disability, where you're from, just a little bit about your background so people get a sense of kind of where you come from and what you're about.
Well, I was born at OSU Hospital, and I born and raised in the Columbus area, and I've had my disability all my life. And I started out in life with a walker, tried to work my way up to crutches. My body just wasn't built to walk, and a lot of my sockets weren't deep enough. I just didn't have the function in my legs to do that. But I also grew up in a time before the ADA. So there was a lot of pressure, and pressure might not be the right word, but there was a lot of emphasis on from family, from professionals, for me to walk. And, you know, quite frankly, there were days that it was pretty painful as a kid. I just remember, feel like I let a lot of people down because it just wasn't working. But when I look back on that, you know, my family didn't. I didn't think they could picture a time even like now where their ramps, physical accessibility is improving. Anybody that has a disability will tell you that, you know, we still have a ways to go. So I started off educationally in a school that was designed for kids with disabilities, and I was mainstreamed. And then when my family moved out to New Albany, I was in the third grade, and for a long time I was the only person with a physical disability. So that, you know, there was obviously you know, my mom, my parents had to push a little bit to get the level of integration, but New Albany was a small town and they adopted quickly. And I felt pretty accepted. So that really is like the beginning of like when I start talking about a disability. But, like, that's a good stopping point. Like, first. And I just remember as a kid, like, not really understanding what was going on, like, and just thinking, at some point, like, I would outgrow it, I would get stronger. And then, I used to tell people when people would ask, like, when the question was usually, why can't you? It wasn't, why can't you walk? It's like, when are you going to be able to walk? And I, would always pick, like, when I was a kid, I was like, oh, it's going to be when I'm 13 or, something like that, because I just really didn't know. So at that time, nobody really sat down and explained to me what CP was and how it affected, was going to affect me or anything like that. So there wasn't that education piece. A lot of it, and you can speak to it too. You just kind of made it up and tried to figure out what you could on your own, and because there wasn't a roadmap, so.
Yeah, I think, when you say that, figure out on your own, I think it's so powerful, Sean. And your story and my story are very similar in a lot of ways. I was born, in Columbus as well. Went to Johnstown, which was a small town outside of New Omni, was also mainstream in the school with disabilities in Newark. Then moved to New Omni when I was, I think I was in sixth grade, because you were a year older than me. I think you were in seventh grade. I was in sixth grade. And we met each other riding the bus, the only accessible bus to school, because it had a wheelchair lift. And I would agree. One of the, I think, challenges, I work at, now in the space of, I work with college students with disabilities. And when I look back, it's, I had a very supportive people, as I think you did, but there wasn't anybody with disabilities to tell us what this was about. And so they were coming at things from an able-bodied perspective. And so I think, what, when I look back, you and I's story, we came into school kind of right as the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act was passed in 1975. So we benefited from that. But the ADA is not passed until we're in seventh grade. It doesn't become law until you're in high school, right? So it like, yeah.
95 it became enforceable, and I had already graduated. And that was one of the things with the high school, just talking about that and doing those, like those the railways in the high school were narrow enough that I could pull myself up the stairs. And then the year after I graduated, they demolished everything, and they started building the new stuff. So yeah.
Yeah, that, the high school we went to, the thing I always say is both you and I wrestled, and we'll get to the sports aspect to this sort of in a second, but both you and I wrestled, and the locker rooms were just hideously inaccessible, right? And then the year after I graduated, it was the year that the new school was built and the first class went, and I joked that they'll probably never have two athletes with cerebral palsy playing a sport again, but they have really accessible locker rooms. And when you and I were wrestling and I was running cross country, the locker rooms were anything but accessible.
Yeah, I mean, like, days that there were practices, like, I would have to wear the stuff that I was gonna wear for practice under the clothes, and I had to be able to get the clothes off quickly. So, because of that reason. And yeah, at the time, like, you don't think about it because you just want to get in there and wrestle and practice and things like that. But yeah, that's true. So.
Yeah, talk a little bit about sports. And just before we get to you playing sports, but just growing up, as a person with a disability, and one of the, I think, myths is that, people with disabilities aren't into sports because they're not active. But talk about the role that just being a sports fan and sports played in your life growing up, played in your family's life, and the role that that kind of shaped your early aspects of your identity.
My family were very fair weather fans. Like, if I think about it, like, there were times that they were very pro Bengals and times that they were very pro Browns. And I remember thinking, like, if you look back and the shift, I really do think it had to do with who was winning. So definitely grew up, with that, and like, and just Ohio State Buckeyes on the radio, like. My kids, if I listen to it on the radio, if I'm driving around, they're like, what, what are you doing? Like, there around here, there isn't, I don't think there is very many games, Ohio State games, that aren't televised. So yeah, definitely that became a big part of my identity in that regard, especially like baseball, because baseball was on more, and like baseball cards was huge for me because you could get the cards and you could memorize the stats and you could follow. It was so much easier to follow people, I think, because those games were on a lot. And it was just like, with a baseball and a glove, you don't need a whole lot else. You can sit in a folding chair and throw a baseball, or sit on the ground and throw a baseball. And, that's what I did a lot. And that eventually, and I can talk more about it later, but that went into like softball, but definitely like following the Reds. Like, I don't remember ever rooting for the Indians much because the Indians weren't very good. And the Reds just, I don't know, seemed to be on TV more. But the year they won the World Series, I think I was a freshman, and it was a big deal. Like, we had a lower level, pulled out the sofa bed, and my parents just let me stay up and watch all of it. And then it grew, and just following individual players, and like, you do have the thought like, well, man, if I was up the bat, I would swing like Will Clark, or like, like play first base like Mattingly and stuff like that. So yeah, I still identify it, but I never took it to the step like, well, I can't really identify with them because physically they can do things that I can't do.
No, I was going to say, I think same thing. I think it's hard for people now too, because all the baseball games are on TV, but the way in which, especially you grew up in Columbus, and the Reds games were on WTVN radio and 700 WLW out of Cincinnati. So those were two big stations, one in Columbus, one in Cincinnati. And like, so Marty and Joe were just on, right? Like, it was that Marty Brenneman and Joe Nuxall were the kind of the soundtrack to, I think, both of our summers. And I think it's funny, I still love baseball, but I listen to it still even more on the radio than I watch it on TV. Like, I put it on when I'm out in the yard doing stuff, or I'm out on the porch. I don't watch as much of it on TV. And I think that's because when I grew up, that's how I sort of took in the Reds was, not every game was on TV. They only had like 30 games they would show on TV. And that 1990 season, the one you're talking about, where they go wire to wire, they beat the Pirates and the league championship series and then sweep the A's, that was just such an amazing experience for Reds fans. And it was part of our, I remember you and I having many heated debates about baseball on the way into school on the bus.
I think especially that, what it was, the San Francisco and Oakland series, was that it was the year after the Reds won.
That was the year before. That was the year before. So yeah, that was the earthquake. That was 89. The Reds won in 90, and then the Twins won in 91. Yeah. The Twins beat the Braves in 91, right? That's so that was, but the, around that, and again, when you're like 12, 13, 14 years old, like, all you have to do is watch sports in some ways. That's like your job. And so it's like, I followed sports back then in a way that I don't now, because I have like other adult responsibilities, right? Yeah. And I don't have time to follow it, but it was like a, such an important part of it. So talk to me a little bit about, you grew up watching it. Did you ever like want, I know you were always active. I remember, I think you guys had a trampoline. You were always jumping on the trampoline. You were always doing stuff outside, but did you ever think you would play sports or end up playing any sports? Did you have that desire, or did you think, I don't know if I'm ever going to get the opportunity?
Well, there are a couple things. It was definitely, I don't know that I'm ever going to get the opportunity, was the biggest thing. And like, like when we moved into the house on Walnut Street, we had that big front yard. And I remember like, it must've been spring break or summer break, just organized a bunch of kids that came over and played. And it was like the biggest deal to me, like, because it was, in my mind, it was the closest thing I was ever going to get to the real thing. And, but then, things changed. Like, And I actually, with wrestling, there was a kid on the news that I knew, and he was a wrestler, and I was like, man, I gotta try. And so that planted the seed. And then right, I think I was 17, so I must have been a junior, is when the wheelchair softball started. And then wheelchair softball, like, where I went to basketball, but I was way too short, way too slow for basketball. And then found rugby. Rugby was great. But man, that was towards the end of, like, I was running out of steam with sports. And then I got into hand cycling. I did some powerlifting. And then I actually worked at a camp, Recreation Unlimited, and we did a lot of adaptive rec stuff for people with more significant developmental disabilities. But, like, it started with wrestling. And if I'm being completely honest, I would have traded any wheelchair sport, as much as I like rugby, to do more wrestling. It's just because it's hard to encapsulate. Like, it was the hardest thing I ever did sports-wise, but it was the most rewarding because I knew that I was, you know, you were going to bleed every day, right? And it was going to hurt, and I was at a big disadvantage, but it felt more real, like, if that makes sense. Because there wasn't any modification. Like, it was just me. And, you know, I was in one of the lightweight classes. So those guys were fast, and they were tall, and, you know, they're not going to get down on your level on their knees and wrestle you, you know. So whatever you do, you're doing against a kid that's got function in all four of their limbs.
Yeah, so I want to back up and talk about that, because both you and I wrestled, and I want to just talk briefly about a mentor who I think was just really positive in both our lives. I want you to give me some thoughts on our wrestling coach and our math teacher, John Galbraith, for my money, you know, I started wrestling when I was in seventh grade, because he sort of knew I had two older brothers that were good athletes, way better athletes than me, and asked me to come out. I think around the same time, even though you were older, he asked you to come out for the wrestling team. Just what was that experience like for you? Because I remember being on cloud nine that he even asked me to play a sport, because, like, I loved sports and never thought I would get to play. And for me, it was part of what I struggled with as we were getting into junior high and people were playing football. And, like, I thought, I'm never going to get this opportunity. And when he asked me, it was like this greatest thing that could have ever happened to me. And so I want you, do you remember how, I know you had the dream, but how did you get connected with John Galbraith? How did you end up actually on the wrestling team?
So what happened was, I was going to go, I fully intended to go in and be like the water boy or the mat person or something like that. It was a practice where they were playing mat. Remember how he had people play mat ball? So you were crawling and scrambling and going after the tape ball and stuff like that. And I'm like, man, I could do that. And he's like, well, why don't you give it a shot? You know, just with the mat ball thing, go home and talk to your parents. And, you know, it was that. The thing I think about Coach Galbraith is that he loved wrestling. And he, one of the things with him is he realized that sport could be for anybody. There's all different shape, size, style of wrestlers, and you know, like, there were times where I was the only person that lost. That's how good that team was, because he was just a really good coach. But it started with loving wrestling. And I remember one time one of our teammates was gonna wrestle a girl, and everybody, you know, was like, you know, whispering, and everybody was like pensive, and he's like, just go out and treat her like any other wrestler. And he said, you know, if a coach knows what he's doing, you can coach a female wrestler, a girl wrestler, to be very successful. So his whole thing was, I don't really think he cared about record. I think he cared about development, and I think it showed. Because, you know, it would be easy for him to say, hey, you guys, you know, you're bringing that, or Sean, you're bringing down the record, let's get somebody else. This whole thing for me was work. Just wrestle a lot of matches. You know what he would do in the preseason. He'd put you in a match against someone that was two weight classes up, and then, you know, you get killed, and he's like, well, what difference does it make what they weigh? You know, like, just go out and get work. And he really loved wrestling. And that was the greatest thing.
Yeah, and I think he also loved kids. I mean, the thing that I really respected, you know, I was 206 in my entire, I started wrestling in seventh grade, wrestled all throughout. I only won two matches, and I lost 106 times. I think I got pinned. Mm-hmm. I said I memorized the lighting grid of every gym in Central Ohio, right? Because I spent that much time on my back. But he never, like, it was about, and when I think about myself now, and I tell my daughter this, and with you saying the thing you said about him focused on the work, I always think of myself as I'm a process over product person in general, as a person with a disability. Like, are you doing, like, when my daughter, for example, will talk about school, I'll say, I care more about the process of what you're doing than necessarily the end result. And I think that may have come through what you just talked about, his commitment to, like, you're going to do the process, you're going to do this the right way. It just is something that stuck with me. The other thing I appreciated, and I don't know if you experienced this, there would have been some coaches who had two disabled wrestlers on the team at the same time that would have milked that for all the media that it was worth and tried to make themselves look good. And he never did that. He never said, look at me, look at how inclusive I am. And I don't know what your thoughts are about that, but that always stuck with me, is that he was one of the most genuine people I ever had the pleasure of meeting as a student or as an educator in my career. He was just so genuinely wanted people, because he loved the sport of wrestling and he wanted it to be inclusive.
Yeah, I that's really interesting what you said. And I'm sure there had to be a behind the scenes conversation, because even the assistant coaches never gave off that vibe. Like, you know, I never felt patronized, you know, like after you know, a match or anything like that. It was always like, okay, this is what you did that was really good, and this is what you did that was really, really sucked. And, like, I mean, but those were the same conversations they were having with everybody else. So I think he probably set the tone with his coaching staff about that too.
Oh, absolutely. And the only thing I'll say is, the one thing is that he also became my cross country coach. And the way that, I don't know if I ever told you the story, Sean, but, you know, I was a sophomore. I think you were a junior when I ran cross country. And I remember he came to me and he said, I think you should run cross country, because basically Coach Galbraith, everybody that wrestled that wasn't playing a fall sport, right, he was going to recruit to, because we had a really good runner named Sean Sweeney. And so they were creating a team around Sean, basically. So he comes to me and goes, I think you should run it. I go, well, what is it? Because I never even really heard of the sport. And he's like, well, you run 3.1 mile races. And I go, well, you know, I'm on crutches, right? And he goes, and his response to me, I'll never forget, he goes, look, if you're disabled, ACT wants to wrestle for me in the winter, you have to run for me in the fall. That's the deal. I don't know if you remember Galbraith, but when he volunteered you to do something, it wasn't so much volunteered as he voluntold you. He was that kind of coach and that kind of mentor, and we trusted him. And so he recruited. And I remember the one thing I think him and I weren't prepared for, because there were disabled wrestlers. And so, you know, we and you and I were wrestled together and we're on the same team, but him and I were not prepared for the reaction that I got at cross country races. Cause his whole thing was like, I don't understand what the big deal is, but like, it was like, you know, to people in the cross country world, a guy running on crutches was like an alien coming from outer space or something. It was just something they'd never seen. But again, I so respected the way that he didn't make a bigger deal out of it than it was, right? He just stuck to the process.
Yeah. I think that explains his philosophy altogether.
Do you is there anything when you look back at it, and the reason I say this, when I think about doing this podcast, I want to do it for people with disabilities, but I also want to do it for able-bodied people who want to be mentors. Is there anything, like, as a person with a disability, based on your experience with, Coach Gabbert and others, that you would tell people who want to coach those with disabilities, like how to handle the disability part of that mentorship?
I think that's a really good question. Because when I played softball, we had our one of our coaches was able-bodied. And so it was just, you know how like in the ADA they talk about an interactive conversation? I think that's what it is. Like, don't come to the table as a coach and think you know everything, but also don't come to the table as a coach and abandon technique and fundamental, because some of it translates. And like, it's always a slippery slope. But one of the practices, our coach got in one of the wheelchairs because they were talking about, I was a catcher, not fast, but they were talking about how to turn a double play faster and turn your hips in the chair and, make the throw. So he spent a lot of time like, trying to understand how to move, trying to understand how people could pivot their hips, because in wheelchair softball, the majority of my teammates had some level of spinal cord injury. But I think it's that. Don't give up on technique. Don't assume that because someone is in a wheelchair that none of the technique is going to translate. But then also, make sure, and saying make sure you're listening is an oversimplification, but I think it really is that. Stick to fundamentals and listen.
So talk to me about, like, once you graduate, just I also want to tell people kind of what your journey's been. And so you wrestled in high school, you graduate from Romney. I think you went to Capital, if I remember right.
Right.
Which is a small liberal arts school sort of outside of the Columbus area. Just to, what was your journey like sports wise and otherwise after high school?
So during high school, when I was 17, I started playing wheelchair softball. There's a great man, and he just passed. His name was John Ball, and he had a spinal cord injury, and he started the team in Columbus, and it was based out of OSU. One of my mom's friends saw a flyer on a table, and she picked it up. And I'm so nervous. My mom called John, but that's how the softball thing started. And I was 17, so I was the youngest person on the team. And I was around all these guys that all walks of life. And when I started using the wheelchair full time, it wasn't like it is now. I literally went to Columbus Medical, and they stuck me in a wheelchair that didn't fit because they thought, hey, you're gonna grow, you're only 17. And that was it. There was no like adaptive programming or adaptive PT at that time to teach you how to use the chair. So like right there, I was a little bit behind the eight ball. But that was one of the benefits of softball, is just being around guys that have lived a life. They would teach you how to, what you needed to do to take care of your wheelchair, how you needed to position yourself, like all these kind of things. And it was really cool to watch, because like we had a couple people join the team that were like 3 months post-injury, and like their progress, it sped up their progress. Not no only knowing someone that could was in the same situation, but could actually teach you stuff. Like, I got my first job at Recreation Unlimited because it's a softball coach. I got, that's where I first started the long process of driving. You know, and then like you just, and you see people leading just regular lives and you're like, oh my goodness, you know, this could happen. And then your parents come in, watch you play, and they're like, oh my gosh, you know, this could really happen. These guys are doing okay. Maybe this kid will be okay. And yeah, but I will say the hardest part for me in wheelchair sports is like, I never played when I was a little kid. And some of these guys, you know, like had played a long time and then they had their injuries. So they adjusted, but they still had, you know, good fundamentals. And I didn't know any of that. And there is, you know, like when I got further along playing, I think I played for, 7 years. You start to see like, there's a little bit of a caste system between the people that acquire their disability and the people that were born with their disability. And, you know, there were a couple of people that were born with their disability that came out to practice and, you know, they practiced for a while. Nobody said anything mean to them and they were very welcoming, but they decided that, you know, they couldn't keep up and they quit playing. You just have to grind at it. Every sport that I played in a wheelchair, I had to grind at. And that's part of the reason why, I stopped playing because I got a job, eventually got married. And then, I would have to practice twice as long to get what I had as compared to, you know, somebody else. And like, there were, you know, some people where they were in their lives, they weren't working. So, you know, they could go out and do extra practice and they could travel and those things like that. They didn't have commitments, but I'll tell you what, like the sport, wheelchair softball really grew too. Like it's international. They play some kind of World Cup in Japan. And the way it was set up, like, different states had different teams, so you would travel as far as you can and then it would end in a big national tournament. So it was a lot of fun and I learned a lot of stuff that I still use, you know, today, obviously.
Well, I think two things you said there that sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but two things that you said there that I think are really important. One is the idea of mentors. And can you talk about that? And because, you know, that's, again, I mentioned this earlier in the podcast, that I think is one of the most challenging things of being disabled. But it's not that this is what people don't understand. It's not that you don't have people who love and support you, but the people who love and support you are able-bodied. And so like, for me, you know, for example, like I have been a runner since I was in high school, but there was nobody to tell me like, what kind of crutches should you have? Like what kind of tips should you by what kind of like how do you take care of your hands, how do you like, you know, do all the things, because there was nobody to show me like how to do this. And so I think that what role, like, did talk about just the role that mentors played in your life. And you mentioned one, you know, that got you into wheelchair softball, but talk about the role that mentors with disabilities have played in your life and how that's impacted how you see your own disability.
It definitely, like, seeing someone, that's working on the same things as you, or at the stage point, at the same point of life that has a disability, it makes it feel a little less, stigmatized. I'll give you a good example because I'm doing a bad job of explaining this. I definitely. And not against using a power wheelchair. I know there's a likelihood down the road that that might be my only option. But so out here in Johnstown, I have a big yard. It takes me a long time to get in the grass, even when it's mowed and stuff like that. So one of my rugby buddies is, hey man, like, you know, why don't you get a power chair just for this stuff? And I was hesitant. Like, oh man, I don't want to do it. Like, well, first of all, I knew I wasn't going to get a brand new one because the insurance wasn't going to pay for it. I found one that was donated, and I got it and I got into it. And yeah, it's not great. It's not comfortable, but getting out of the yard and playing with the kids or, you know, moving a branch or something like that crazy, it definitely helps. And then when COVID hit, I was like, man, am I putting myself at risk touching my tires? Like, I didn't know. So that's when I first got that power chair, and I took it out to the mall, and it was hard to drive. Like, I was not used to it. But I think, like, as far as mentorship, it's just like stuff like that. Hey, man, it's not that big of a deal. Or, hey, this really helps doing this. Or the first time you see somebody, I have a friend who was a chef, and he taught culinary from his wheelchair. The first time you go in his house, and he's got a roll under stovetop, and you're like, wow, that's a lot easier. Or just like, I think one area that everybody with a disability is really benefiting from is advances in tech. And I wish they would come a little bit faster, but the whole idea of like high tech and low tech stuff. And like, there's people at work that I talk with all the time, like, okay, what are low tech cheap modifications to do X, Y, and Z? Like in my house, I have a bunch of power strips, that have adhesive Velcro, and they're stuck to the wall where I can reach them easily so I can plug stuff in. But it's just stuff like that. Is those quick conversations that make life a lot easier. And the same, like, I'm trying to think. Like, okay, dating. Like, softball was wild because most of the guys were married, and then there were a few that weren't, but it was really the guys that were married, like their wives, because I was so young, 17, like so shy, and they would be like, you know, like, don't be embarrassed by this, don't be embarrassed by that, like, you know, you're gonna find people that you know, the wheelchair is not a big deal, the disability is not a big deal. And again, they didn't say X, Y, and Z to get a girlfriend, but it was that whole idea, like, it can be done, I can be myself, I can talk about it, you know, and it's not going to be that big of a deal.
That's really cool. And, you know, I think about the dating thing, which I'm going to talk about in a second, like, because, you know, for me, that was a big challenge. And when I look back at it, I think it was part disability, also part because I was, quite frankly, a jerk. I was just not a nice person when I was in high school. When I look back at that now and studying identity the way that I have for my career, I understand, like, I really didn't like the fact that I was disabled, and I did everything I could to prove I wasn't. And it wasn't until I, like, came to terms with the fact that, like, I like being disabled, I love it. Wouldn't trade it. It wasn't until I got completely comfortable in my disabled skin that I became like a tolerable and better person. And that allowed me to then, you know, engage in intimate relationships. But talk a little bit about, like, you know, what were, you know, you're in college, you're getting a job. What was for you some of the bigger challenges dating wise, if you don't mind sharing what that was like for you, and what were some of the challenges there?
Well, I will tell you all about that. But I think to your point about, you know, like it being hard, because, you know, in high school, you are living in two worlds. We didn't have anybody else to look around and be like, hey, you know, like there's a mentor or a positive influence that has a disability. You didn't even see folks on TV. And then so, like, you're in the mode of constantly feeling like you have to hide it or compensate for it or not talk about it. And it's a terrible way to live. Like, I don't know if you remember my friend, Bo. We were down in Florida and visiting his brother. And every time someone held the door for me, and this was right before I went to college, I get so mad. Be like, oh, you know, I haven't said stuff under my breath. And I'd be like, hey, you did your good deed for the day. You held the door for the guy in the wheelchair. And he got so mad, and he's like, man, you're being stupid. People hold the door for each other because people are nice. And I wanted to prove him wrong so bad. So I sat there. He went in the store, and I sat there and watched. And sure enough, what did I see? People being nice, like holding the door for each other. And it seems like such a little story, but it really did change my life. And to the point where, like, even at Capitol, I was the only person for a while that had a physical disability. So, you know, right about that time with the door thing, I was putting so much pressure on myself, like, I gotta do this, I gotta do that, because everybody's looking at me because, you know, I'm in a wheelchair. And, you know, that's not reality too, but that's kind of where we came from, because, you know, like, again, it's that being the only one kind of thing. And once I got over that.
Yeah. And yeah. You know, I always say, what I tell my students, and I pick this up, is I always tell students, like, I don't want to invalidate their feelings. I'll say, your feelings are real. Like, your feelings were real, but are they true? It's something I ask all my students. Yeah. I understand you really feel this way, but is it true? Is it accurate? Right? Because there's a difference between a feeling that's real versus a feeling that's actually what's happening.
Yeah.
But you know, like, so, go ahead.
Dating. So I told you I worked at that summer camp, and so, like, the majority of the staff were girls, and you live together, you work together, you know, you, like, it's everything that a summer camp was. What it helped, two things. Being honest, I was one of the only few guys, right? So we used to say camp is an island. And then, but it gave people an opportunity to, like, see me and what I was doing, gave me an opportunity to relax and let people in. So that was helpful. I've been divorced for, I think, 5 or 6 years. And now it's all on the online stuff. And, like, so you go back and forth, you're like, do I mention the disability, do or not? And, like, I always do. And I don't know if it hurts me or not, but I don't want to put somebody on the defensive. And I don't want to surprise anybody, because their reaction is going to be awkward. You know, like, you're not expecting a guy in a, you know, wheelchair that doesn't like to wear shoes. If I really want something that's going to last, then, you know, I don't want to start off with a deception. And so, yeah. And, like, right now, like, I haven't done any dating in a long time.
It is.
I'm too busy. It's that thing.
It is challenging. I mean, I met my wife on Facebook when it was back just for college kids, how we met. And, you know, it's funny that when I first met her, there was a picture of me running, and there was a picture of somebody in the back. And I said, I was beating. And I said, do you find me inspirational? Because I didn't really want to date somebody who was all into the being inspired. Because, like, the truth is, Sean, you know this, like, there are sometimes, like, we're not that inspiring and we can't always live up to that. But her response was great. She was like, well, should I be? Because she wasn't sure which one I was. She wasn't sure, is he the guy in the back or is he the guy in the front? Like, she didn't know which one it was in the picture. And she just always had kind of this attitude about it. And has always been, you know, been pretty chill about it. I think the thing that's helped out, you know, it'll be our 12th anniversary this year. I think the thing that's helped us is I also allow her to be mad at it. Like, you know, we love the fact that I'm disabled, and she does work with people with disabilities as well. And her job, she's a rehab services counselor, gets people jobs and does workplace accommodations. But, like, we always say, like, I always tell her, because we're in an interability relationship, I have an obvious physical disability, she does not, like, that it's okay to actually admit that sometimes the disability sucks. Like, you know, like, that's the reality of it. And I think that's been a helpful thing in our relationship, you know, and with our daughter. And I want to talk a little bit about that, because you have two children. Like, what would you like people who are able-bodied who might someday listen to this podcast know about what it's like to raise kids and be a person with an obvious disability? What's that been like for you? What's been the biggest challenge? What's been the most rewarding part?
That is a very loaded and very important question. So, like I told you, I'm a social worker. I actually work with kids and families 3 to 13 that have disabilities as well. So I help navigate all the systems, get them what they need. And so you think that it would be really easy for me to talk to my own kids about my disability. And part of, in my opinion, any good social worker goes into, you know, therapy at some point in their life, because you gotta, like, you gotta just check your instrument too. But one of my questions was, when the kids were coming, what do I tell them about all this? How do I explain all this? And counselor just, and she didn't have a disability, she's just like, tell them the truth. So from a very early age, I was like, sometimes being in a wheelchair sucks, to your point. Sometimes it's great. You know, and as they get older, like, we had a conversation and something, I don't know, something happened. And my oldest is just like, well, just tell me you're in a wheelchair, and he goes slower. And I was like, that doesn't work. Like, just because I'm in a wheelchair, I have to be able to do this the same as, you know, anybody else. Like, I don't always get a free pass, you know? And like, my kids are, because I have family members who have children on the spectrum, and so they're pretty sensitive about that, and like, want everybody to be included. There's that Eli has a friend that has Down syndrome, and he gets really angry if he feels like that kids left out or picked on, and their mom actually works at a day hub. So they get it that way, but like, it's tough because the hardest thing was when they wanted to help me. And I'm like, man, I don't know what to do with this, because I don't want them to feel like they have to help me, but I don't want them to, you know, to be scared, you know, to talk about that and to help me if I really need it. So right now, you know, we're in a good spot. Like, you know, they get it a little bit, like, and they're just helpful kids. Like, if I saw them only helping me do stuff, then I would be a little bit more hesitant, but they're, for whatever reason, they're wired just to be helpful.
Maybe it comes from, you know, living with you every day. I mean, how much of it, I mean, I do think, because my daughter is, you wouldn't know it by how she behaves when she's at home with us, but according to all of her teachers, she's super helpful and super sweet. And I think it comes with, she's very go with the flow. And part of me wonders if, like, she's had to be that way, because, like, I have a disability, I don't drive, I do the bus, like, all those things. She's just kind of grown up with it, and so she's just comfortable with it.
Yeah. Well, like, and I joke around a lot. And so, you know, we've had the discussion about, cause I don't take it too seriously. You know, I'm pretty tough to offend, but I always want them to, there's a difference between an inside the house joke and an outside the house joke. Like, we were in church, and, you know, the priest asked everybody to stand up, and Eli looks over his shoulder and he's like, sorry about that, Dad. But he said it too loud, and all these people like turned around and looked at him. I'm like, buddy, inside joke versus outside joke. And he's like, yeah, I got it. But
you know, do you find that your kids struggle? I think Lily's biggest struggle, who's my daughter, who is nine, like, her biggest struggle is when other people react to me. For example, this Halloween, we went and I was walking, and Jen was in the car because we had to drive to a different neighborhood. So I was out walking with Lily, and like, this guy comes up and he's like, you're being heroic because you're walking with your daughter. And like, Lily's just rolling her eyes, like, because to her, like, it's just a thing that I would do. It's not like, it's not heroic. I'm just helping her get candy, right? There's nothing, you know.
Yeah.
And so do you have similar experiences with your kids where they're like, they respond more to how people respond to you than almost anything else?
That's a tough question, because the comment they get the most or hear the most is about them being a helper. And I don't think they associate it with their being a helper because that person perceives that I can't do it, or they just like the idea of being recognized as a helper. So, yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I'd have to ask. Like, there's always the conversation about, like, you know, can I get into somebody's house? Or, you know, at this point, he's 9 or almost 11. Do I need to go to somebody's house? Like, and, you know, it's Johnstown, small town. And, you know, you get in that bubble with all the kids, parents that are the same age. And so, yeah, I don't really know. I don't know what they would do. That it's a really good question. And then one of their really good basketball coaches, their father was had an accident and he was paralyzed too. So that guy was like, you know, he obviously he got it. So you know, but I haven't been called to do any presentations at school or anything like where, you know, I would really be putting that at the forefront anyway, but it's a really good question. I'll ask their mom because, you know, like, they'll go to the day hab with their mom and, like, they still struggle for the right word to encapsulate some of that. Like, everything to them is autism and, you know, so I've been talking about, like, you know, the different kinds of disabilities. And so that conversation has come a little bit more in. But yeah, I don't know. I'm going to have to pay attention to that.
Yeah, they could
be. It's definitely made them more independent, for sure. You know, like, I don't know. Like, they like to fish. So they know there's certain ponds that, yeah, I'm not going to be able to get down, you know, super close to the water because I'm not going to be able to get back up. But, yeah, you know, like the remedy to that is they want to learn how to bait their own hooks anyway. So, you know, stuff like that. So as they get getting older, they need less of like the physical me and more of like the, like, hey, don't mess this up with this friend, that kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's funny you say that. It's always interesting to me, and it could be because you are in a smaller town. Johnstown is a small town, sort of 10 or so miles outside of the city of Columbus, and it's an interesting place. I wonder, like, we're in a bigger city, right? Like, we're in Richmond. We've been in Charlotte, North Carolina. I wonder if being in a bigger city where it's not that small, because I didn't really realize how different I was until we moved to Nuwamnee. Because originally, when I was a kid, like, I had just kind of grown up with my brother's friends. And so, like, it was my disability just kind of was what it was. And it wasn't until, like, I moved to another place, I was like, wow, people really see me as different. One of the things I wanted to ask you, getting back to the sports thing, do you think, like, one of the reasons I like talking about adaptive rec and sports and physical activity for people with disabilities is that I think it's a good metaphor for living with a disability. And you talked a couple of times about, like, you know, wrestling grinding, softball grinding. Do you see there's parallels in your mind between, like, playing a sport and disability and what it teaches you for being disabled in everyday life, that you just got to kind of grind and adapt?
Oh, sure. Because, like, especially, you know, like, I have my kids on a certain schedule, and when they're not here, I'm by myself. Now, my family's not too terribly far away, so, like, if it was a true emergency, you know, they're close enough, but, like, there's times where, man, you gotta figure it out, you know, like, and you've gotta adjust. The one thing that always surprises me and still frustrates me a little bit is that people without disabilities think, like, there's a manual, and just because, like, you've had your disability for a while, like, those adjustments are automatic, like, you can make them on the fly. You can't really do that. Like, when the kids were babies, like, I was lucky enough to find somebody that could modify a crib that I could open, because I couldn't reach over the crib from the wheelchair and pick them up. You know, and, like, I tried all the carriers, but they really didn't like sitting in the carriers on my lap. So you learn how to, you know, push a wheelchair one-handed. But it takes time, you know, like with any independent living skill, and then things get messed up. Like, I have enough leg function that I can still stand, and I was going up my ramp and my chair slid out from under me, and I'm like, oh my gosh, you know, what am I going to do? And I'm just like, oh, just stand up. But I forget that, you know, I can do it. Like, you know, and like you slip off your shower bench, like there's nobody that, you know, you gonna be able to yell for. So you gotta figure out how to get up from that, you know? So that grinding, that like, okay, don't panic. You've been here before, take a deep breath, figure it out. It translates into to everything. Like, yeah.
I mean, I definitely think that's the case. People ask me why I run. One of the reasons is that I want to stay in shape. You know, like we went to Disney World and we did this one ride in Tomorrowland in Magic Kingdom. And like they had to stop the ramp, but it was vertical. And I had to basically like climb up it on crutches. And like that, wow. I could hear people murmuring, like they didn't think I was going to make it because it's a pretty steep incline. And probably one of my prouder moments is I could hear Lily saying, "My daddy will make it. He is strong." Like, so, you know, yeah. And when I made it up the ramp and then down the ramp, I told my wife, I said, "That's why I run every day. That ability to have the balance, the strength to do all those things, because there'll become a time where I can't do that anymore. Like it'll go away as I age." But like, that whole thing of like, and I think you probably feel this too. Do you feel pressure to stay in as good a shape as you can? Because I feel like as a person with a disability, like if we get out of shape, we have less to start with, right? It could be really bad for our everyday, like just our everyday ability to do things simple, like take a shower, go to the bathroom, those things that able-bodied people, you know, take for granted.
Yeah. It's that mentality, like, oh man, if something happens to, you know, if I get too fat or whatever, you know, I'm not going to be able to transfer and all that stuff. And, you know, my dad died pretty early on, and like, you know, from 17 on, and like my thought is, you know, I'm going to do everything that I can, you know, so my kids don't have to experience that. But the other thing is too, is like, and this is a terrible thought, but like, and I don't know because I don't investigate, but like, I don't know too many old, I said this out loud to somebody who's a friend. I said, I don't know too many old people with CP. And then, you know, the truth is like, Sean, you got kids, you don't get out much anymore. You don't know a whole lot of like people your age. They're all like little kids or parents that are just as busy as you are. So like, there's that thought. And like, I have a hard time accepting because am I 47, 48? I'm 48. I have a hard time accepting, like, oh, you're getting older. These things automatically have to happen to you. They might, but, like, I don't want to accept that. And I can only walk with a walker a few steps, but the past 3 years, I've gained some flexibility in some range of motion in my legs, and the occupational therapist, he's like, yeah, you know, you can tell you're putting in the work because that usually doesn't happen. But that's it. Like, the weight is terrifying because at one point I was up to, you know, 160 and I'm down to 130, but man, it took work. And, you know, in my situation, because I don't have much leg function, you know, like there is no full body cardio for me. The closest thing I can get is the hand bike or pushing the chair for a while. So, man, like, I think you're spot on. You know, move everything as much as you can, run as much as you can, like, because it's the best way. Like, I see people that are heavier, and like, one example, a lady lives alone. She was my age, but she's heavier and she hadn't been taking care of herself. And she lived alone. And I watched her transfer from a regular chair back to her wheelchair. She couldn't do it without assistance. And I'm like, man, what if you're living alone and there's a fire? You know, like, you got to be able to do that quick. So in my world, like, I'm on the floor every day, you know, just so I'm, you know, stretching out or practicing getting back in my chair. And that it is a little bit of paranoia, like, you know, about losing functioning. But at the same time, it's like, you know, there's nothing I can do about it. I gotta practice it. Like,
well, what I think people don't understand is it's preparing for a world that's not built for you. You know, houses are not built for you. So you have to practice, like, navigating. Like, the house we currently live in is a split level, right? So you want, there's stairs in the house, there's a downstairs and an upstairs. And, like, you know, I'm doing laundry, I'm dragging baskets up and stairs. And so you do those things because it's what you have to do to have the kind of life you want to have. And so people, again, don't think about those things, but I had the same thing. I mean, I know when Lily was born and for her first birthday, we invited so many people, Sean. It was like, there must have been like 40, 50 people. And some people were like, why were there so many people? And I tried to explain to people, because 14-year-old me in eighth grade in New Albany, struggling with identity and all those things, never thought this was possible, right? Like, and so I'm going to soak this in, right? And I think that's the thing people don't understand. Like, you getting out of your chair is like, you're a very successful person. You have, you know, you have a job, you know, in a world where 70% of people with disabilities don't have a job, right? So, like, when you think about those things, all those things you do are part of what make you successful, right?
Yeah. And like the identity piece, it's always going to be, okay, I'll give you a perfect example of sports, right? Like, so rugby, in order to play quad rugby, you have to have a disability that affects all four of your limbs. So, like, I have, my hands are kind of, the thumb and the first two fingers are really good, and the last two kind of curl in, kind of weak. So, I qualified to play rugby, and even then, like, I went to a clinic and there was an Olympian there, and, you know, he watched me play, and then he watched me. There was a really, like, I'm slow, but there was a really big guy, and he was like 300 pounds, and I was able to pick him and hold him and make a lane for my teammate. And he just looked at me and he's like, I have no idea what to do with you. Because, you know, I could also palm the ball, so I could throw the volleyball, like, because that's what they use in rugby. But again, super slow, you know, like, but I could hold guys and I could throw. And he looked at me and he's like, you know, I don't know what to do with you. So even there, like, you're stuck in a kind of a limbo world. Like, I'm not this or I'm not that. I'm either, you know, like, not disabled or too disabled, or like, and you know, you just gotta let it go. And okay, this is what I can do for the team. This is what I can bring to the table. This is what I'm struggling with. This is what else I'm learning. Like, it took me a long time to get over my sorrow reflex, my flinch when I was catching a ball. But man, like, the only thing you can do is just sit there and catch and catch and catch and catch. And eventually, it never goes away fully, but it gets better now because I haven't played in a while. I'm sure, you know, I'd have to work again and to get it back there. But yeah, so as far as identity, it's so weird. And I think, like, you know, there is no comfort level either. Okay, if you don't want people to see your disability and treat you differently, but then if you need something that's related to your disability, the person you're talking to or the person that's receiving your message doesn't know what to do with you because you don't fit in a box. Or you don't fit in that category anymore. Like, you know, I don't want to be known for a person as a disability and an athlete that had a disability, but I also don't want it to be like go away, because there are things that are important about it. There's strengths. There's times I need help. There's perspective, like, that all are related to that. But like, to strip it down and say, you either are or you aren't, isn't really all that fair. But internally, where do you find the comfort in that?
Yeah, I think that's a great thing you said. I think it's very complex. I know we've talked for a long time. I know you're busy. I don't want to take any more of your time, but I want to give you a chance. Is there anything I didn't ask you about, or is there anything you want to say to a message either to other people with disabilities who might eventually listen to this podcast, or to people who don't have disabilities that you want to say about your life as a person with a disability, as an athlete with a disability, or as a father or husband, all that stuff. With a disability, all the things you've experienced.
Oh man, that's such a big question. But there's so many great communities of people, especially in the sports world, that are ready to accept you, like and like having people with disabilities involved, even if you're brand new, because you come out with that energy that we had when we were kids, just excited to be a part of it and excited to participate in and be a part of that community. I think that one of the biggest things is, like, I experienced that the most in the climbing community. And if I had a child with CP today, like, I would get them involved with climbing, to the extent that you can, because it stretches out. You're going to use the leg function you have. You're definitely going to use grip and hand function that you learn. Like, when I stand up to get into bed at night, I use a pinch grasp that I learned in climbing when I was, 38 years old. But those communities are, infectious, and they need us. They want our input. Even like these kids coming up, like the techniques, the coaching, the equipment is getting so much better. But into the athlete this would be listening, just, don't take it for granted. Like, I don't want to be the old guy in a wheelchair that says, "Hey, we didn't have this when you were a kid." But like, this stuff is not automatic. And the people that, started all the sports and all the programs, started from nothing, started in VA hospitals after wars and just wanted to compete. And like, it's grown into this. So, take care of it, be a good steward, enjoy it. Help someone along the way if you can. That would be my message.
Thank you so much. I think that's such a powerful message. And I really appreciate you coming on and sharing personal stuff and sharing stories. This podcast is about, the stories of those with disabilities, disabled folks, and our perspectives. I think you've got unique experiences. You do a lot of great work in your community. And I don't know if you know this, but I just want to tell you this. I've always just had immense respect for you. We've known each other a long time, and like I said, you and I had very, I think, similar journeys, kind of, and similar struggles in the town that we did, and similar joys as well. But I've always had immense respect for you and the way that you handled yourself.
That's definitely mutual. I check your Facebook posts every time you post about your distance, and man, I just remember those wooden crutches, and I cannot believe, like that you ran on those for so long, because they're so heavy. And before the podcast started, we talked about, like, our paths almost crossing, and every person that I talked to. And most of them were OU graduates, teachers, early intervention. Like, they had such immense respect for you and what you've taught them. The discussion never really led with, like, "Hey, did you know he used to run cross country?" It was like, "Man, this guy, you go into his classroom and he comes at you with this, and he teaches you this perspective." And then at the very end of those conversations, it was always like, "Hey, I went to high school with him. Did he ever talk about this?" And then that was just like the icing on the cake. So yeah, the respect thing is mutual. And like I said, I check your Facebook post every time you post it. So I
Yeah.
appreciate you giving me the time to talk.
No, and I check your kid and always love stuff with your kids and check what you're doing as well. So keep it up, man.
Imagine a world where children with disabilities have an opportunity to learn, compete, grow, and thrive, each in their own way. That's the vision behind Winning Pathways Foundation. This nonprofit is committed to unlocking abilities and opening opportunities for children with disabilities through educational scholarships, family support, and access to competitive adaptive sports. Winning Pathways programs often support youth pursuing competitive pathways in adaptive athletics, but their overall mission is rooted in inclusion, recognizing and celebrating the unique strengths of every child, whether they dream of the podium, the classroom, or both. Whether it's helping a young athlete get to nationals or funding a future college graduate, Winning Pathways is there for every step of that journey. And here's the best part. It's all powered by community through partnerships, donations, and events that bring ability to the forefront. If you're passionate about equality, inclusion, and creating lifelong impact, you can be a part of this movement. Please visit winningpathways.org to learn more, get involved, make a gift, or even purchase some fun gear, which I'm going to do because it looks really cool and it will help support this great organization. Because remember, every child deserves a pathway to win. We got to go. We got to get out of here. But he's a running man. Here's the one thing I know. We got to go, y'all. But he is the running man. He runs around town, all around. Don't run nobody down. Ooh, well, check us out, son. Ooh, the running man. Yeah.